It's Jeff Levering for Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. Check out that effortless horizontal window slide and the best lifetime warranties in the industry. Order by April 30th and get 0% for 48 months at PellaWI.com.
Certain restrictions apply.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the WTMJ talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. All right. It was short-lived this morning. One of my very, very favorite times of the day. It's the moment when I kind of wake up in the morning and I'm at my beautiful wife is next to me in bed, and our dog is typically like on a pillow or in a little doggy bed on the floor. And I just, I have this momentary thing where I'm thinking life is really pretty good, you know, and it just, and sometimes that lasts for a long time. Sometimes it doesn't last for as long. And then there's days like this morning. So I'm like, oh, this is great. You know, my wife's with me in bed and the dog's on the floor. Everything's good. And then what happens is my wife wakes up and she turns on Good Morning America. All right, which is how she likes to start her day. And on Good Morning America, they have an interview with somebody that they identify as like a 17-year-old kid who is part of this weird little internet group calling themselves Discord. And if you've been following the leaks of all this classified information that we'll get into in just a minute, that this kid is part of this group. And he's talking about this, and they've got him blacked out, but he's on TV, you know, with the permission of his parents. And he's talking about, yeah, we're part of this group, and I know who the guy was that did this, and his initials are OG. And we'll get into it in just a minute, but the Washington Post has this huge story about how all this happened. And the kid is talking, and he's saying, yeah, we got these documents, and apparently what happened is this OG guy, you know, would been putting these documents out for weeks to this little, like, weird little internet group that they have, and it hadn't been getting any sort of traction. So he started actually, like, yelling at members of the group that they weren't publicizing this more and more. So they go into this, and I'm watching about this leak and all these confidential documents, which has caused all these problems. And then at the end of it, there's, again, talking to this, like, 17-year-old kid who says that he will not divulge the identity of OG or his location to law enforcement until he is either captured or can flee the United States. I think I might be detained eventually. I think there might be short investigations on how I knew this guy, and they'll try to get something out of me. They might threaten me with prison time if I don't reveal their identity. But he says, he was my best friend, and I'm not going to cooperate. At which point in time, this moment of peace that I have in the morning, it's completely shot, because I find myself yelling at the TV, you miserable little punk. Here's what should happen. All right. As soon as you and this thing airs, somebody from the FBI should serve you with a grand jury subpoena, because they know who this kid is. And the grand jury subpoena should be bringing you in front of the grand jury this afternoon. And you should be asked about all the stuff that you've just disclosed on TV, including who this person is. And if you choose not to disclose this, then what happens is you get hauled in front of a federal judge. You get immunized so that nothing you can say can be used against you. You get taken back to the grand jury. You get asked these questions again. And if you refuse to give the information, your sorry little butt goes and sits in a federal prison. 17 or not doesn't make any difference. This idea that, well, I'm not going to cooperate. I'm not going to tell anybody who this is. Who does this kid think he is? And so this is how I start my day. I'm screaming at the TV thinking, you got some 17-year-old punk on this internet chat board who decides that he does not have to disclose. I don't have to cooperate with somebody who is committed in the investigation of somebody who has committed treason against the United States. Like, who do you think you are, you little punk? And beyond that, you know, if you passed on these documents, maybe you too are guilty of a crime. And if you decide that you don't want to cooperate and, you know, you're not going to go along with this and you don't want to be immunized, maybe you should be looked at for treason as well. So that's how I start my day, thinking, how have we gotten to this point where you have these 17-year-old punks that decide that, all right, I am not going to cooperate in an investigation of massive, massive scope. Now, for those of you who have not been following this story, and they now know and are identifying who it was that was the quote-unquote leaker. But this leak is different than other leaks in the past. You know, you might remember the most famous leak was, of course, probably the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg, this was at the height of the Vietnam War. And Ellsberg had been, you know, working for the Pentagon, or he'd been working at some of these organizations that were affiliated with the Pentagon, and they had been compiling a history of how the U.S. got involved in Southeast Asia. And what ended up happening about this is, it turns out, no surprise, that various administrations, certainly the Eisenhower administration and definitely the Kennedy administration, and certainly the Johnson administration, had been lying to the American public about what was going on in Southeast Asia. And so Ellsberg decided he was going to make these things public. I think a huge mistake that Nixon made, and he made many, was instead of recognizing that these documents didn't reflect badly on the Nixon administration, they were actually historical sort of documents, but Nixon allowed Henry Kissinger to convince him that this was, you know, we had to make Daniel Ellsberg the public enemy number one. And so instead of focusing on, all right, this is previous administrations who screwed this up, they decided to become a crusader and go after Ellsberg and hit all the First Amendment issues. But that was an historical look. The Edward Snowden, the WikiLeaks leak about a decade ago, that was a historical analysis of what was going on. What's different about this leak is it's real time. And these documents that were leaked over a period of time involve current intelligence, revealing, you know, sources that the U.S. has and how they've penetrated the Russian military and the information that they use to, I mean, warn Ukraine about where attacks are coming from, and, you know, critical analysis of the U.S.'s ongoing, current, real-time relationship with our allies. This has caused a huge amount of damage. It's not just like some historical thing looking back saying, okay, this is what the government did 18 years ago to get us involved in Southeast Asia. It has created a huge, huge problem for the United States. And it's a problem that's going to follow the United States for a number of years, because now a number of allies are going to say, well, wait a second, why should we cooperate with you? Why should we share information with you when, you know, our information may, you know, end up on the internet? And then you'll have 17-year-old punks who know who did it, who don't decide they want to cooperate. Well, here is the latest development. During Eric's newscast, he was talking about a story in the New York Times. I've got a big story in front of me, the Wall Street Journal. Here's what they're reporting. Leaked documents likely came from Air Guardsmen at Fort Bragg. An arrest in the case concerning purported classified Pentagon and CIA documents could happen as early as today. Investigators believe the leak of purported highly classified documents on Ukraine and dozens of other subjects likely originated from an Air National Guardsman who was based at Fort Bragg, what's that, North Carolina, at the time of the leak, U.S. officials have said. One of the officials identified the guardsman as Jack Texaria, 21 years old, of Bristol, Massachusetts. Mr. Texaria couldn't immediately be reached for comment. Yeah, I think that's probably an understatement. So anyhow, apparently they have now identified who it was that they believe was responsible for this. And my guess is, if he hasn't figured out a way to get out of the country yet and go to a country where they don't extradite you, my guess is he's probably in custody at this point in time. But it turns out to be, at least according to what's being reported, a 21-year-old Air National Guardsman who was able to get access to some of the most highly classified documents that the United States has, and over a period of months was able to, and what they think happened is he would be able to get the physical hard copies of these documents, and he would take them out of the secured rooms. He would photograph them with his cell phone, and then kind of replace them, but then he'd take these photographs of these documents and he'd put them out on the internet. All right. Our number, 855-616-1620. That is the WTMJ talk and text line. I guess I have 2 points, and I want to open up the phone lines to discuss this. First of all, how in God's green earth can a 21-year-old Air National Guardsman from Fort Bragg have access to all these type of documents? If you want to talk about a screaming problem here, this would be it. These are some of the most confidential, sensitive documents that the United States has. And a 21-year-old Air National Guardsman, who, by the way, is hooked up with some of these fringe gamer groups, he's able to get access to these documents. What is wrong with this picture? Comment number two. If it is, in fact, this 21-year-old Air National Guardsman, I think what he did is treasonous. I think he needs to and must be prosecuted for treason. I would throw the book at him. And if he ends up spending the rest of his life in a federal prison, I'm not going to feel sorry at all. This is a big, big, big. Did I say big? This is a big deal. And the authorities need to come down on him like a house of bricks. If you read the account in the Washington Post, it seems like he wasn't a whistleblower. He was just, I think, one of these sort of losers that's out there in the depths of the internet who wanted attention, to the point that apparently some of the other people that are on this like weird little internet chat group that he's on, he was like yelling at them because they weren't taking this information he was providing and doing more with it. It was like this weird cry for attention. Well, okay, he's got attention now, and I think he should have like the next 40 or 50 years to think about what he's done. 855-616-1620. What do you think? It is so predictable. The first three texts, this is Trump. This is all Trump's fault. This is just like Trump withholding the classified documents. You know, for all you Trump haters out there, you really need to get over it. Your life, and I'm a guy that wants Donald Trump to go away, right? But your life, it will be much better if you just kind of move on and recognize that, gee, Donald Trump taking some classified documents, or Joe Biden squirreling away documents that are classified and putting them in, you know, his office in wherever, is much different than an active duty military guy taking contemporaneous information and putting it out there in real time, disclosing secrets that the United States has with regard to how they are helping Ukraine operate the war or their relationships with all sorts of allies. If you can't see that difference, I can't help you. And you know, it's just you got to get past these blinders of the "I hate Trump, I hate Trump." This is completely different. You can continue to hate Trump, but this is not the same thing. 855-616-1620. To me, I think, if nothing else, beyond punishing this Air National Guardsman, this is the time for the entire government system to take a big look at how does a 21-year-old Air National Guardsman get access to all this type of information, number one, and number two, how is he able to post stuff for months, and nobody recognizes this? It demonstrates an incredible, to me, flaw in our national security system. And like I say, this is a big deal. This isn't Joe Biden squirreling away records from his days as a vice president, or it's not Donald Trump, you know, walking away with some security documents that he ends up, you know, putting in Mar-a-Lago. All that stuff was wrong, but this isn't close to this. This is treason. Pure and simple. 855-616-1620. And for the 17-year-old who decides, well, I'm not going to cooperate with the government in my investigation of this, who do these people think that they are? 855-616-1620. Jeff, what rank is this guy? Is he a military aide to a high officer of some sort? Don't know. All the reports that I have says that he is an Air National Guardsman based at Fort Bragg at the type of the leak. Jeff, Fort Leavenworth, making little rocks out of big rocks. Well, there's an interesting thing. Jeff, it's interesting and perplexing how young people get attention these days. That's the other aspect of this, and I was talking about it with my wife this morning as I'm watching this thing on Good Morning America. The 17-year-old who went on TV, okay, this was with the blessing of his parents. I am trying to imagine what parent in their right mind finds out that their kid has been in the middle of, or at least the recipient of, highly classified government information, and that their kid's decided that he does not want to cooperate with authorities. What parent in their right mind thinks it's a good idea to put their kid front and center on national television or interviews with the Washington Post? Who does that? The first call, if you had a responsible parent, would be to the FBI saying, hey, you know, little Johnny here, he knows who it is that's committed treason against the United States. And you know what we're going to do? You know, send these agents over here and we're going to sit in the living room and he's going to tell you everything he knows about this person who was responsible for that. That's, you would think, what a responsible parent would do, not say, hey, you know, we're going to go tell our story. Everybody wants their 15 minutes of fame. 855-616-1620. Jeff, there were 1.25 million people with clearance and access to read top secret material in the U.S. Who do you think is in the military? The average age is 23. Here is the thing. There should not be 1.25 million people who have access to these sort of documents. You know, no question about it. Jeff, it's treason. It is treason. There's no question about it. Jeff, I totally agree with you about punishments for the 21-year-old, but what about the officers in charge? Well, I think that that's a fair sort of analysis, too. How can you, and if you look at where these documents came from, this wasn't a hack. This guy was able to physically get the reports. They were folded up. He would walk them out of the secured office and he would put them on like backdrops. Like sometimes it was like beds, things like that. And he'd take pictures of them. How cavalier can you be with government documents when, you know, it comes out and says this? Bottom line is I assume that the authorities, if they're already putting out this guy's name, I assume he's probably already in handcuffs somewhere. I know Joe Biden says, well, we don't think this did a lot of damage. Well, it's done an incredible amount of damage. It might have done, if not permanent damage, it might have done certainly long-term damage to our intelligence gathering capabilities. It might have very well put lives at risk moving forward. And if it's all just to try to get some weird form of attention from some of the people who were in this small little corner of the internet, well, like I say, I hope he has decades and decades and decades, either in federal prison or at Leavenworth, to think this over. And as far as the parents and the 17-year-old who decide it's a good idea to go on TV and say, we know who this is, but we're not going to cooperate with authorities, well, this kid's got a lot of problems himself moving forward. Inflation, the return of the bear, 2023 sectors, and answering all your questions about it. Join Dave Spano from Annex Wealth Management, along with Wisconsin's Afternoon News host, John McCure, for a special webinar, Inflation, Rate Hikes, and Bears. Oh, my. See, got that Wizard of Oz sort of analogy there. On Wednesday, April 19th at 11 a.m., you can register for this free webinar at WTMJ.com. Click on the Features tab and visit the Annex Wealth Management webinar page. Okay, as long as I'm, like, talking about yelling at things, I'm ranting at the TV when I see this 17-year-old punk whose parents have let him go on TV and say, oh, I know who this traitor was. I know all about this document, but I'm not going to cooperate with the government. And my response was, okay, well, I think not, young man. And if I were running the investigation out, it appears that they know who did it and stuff. But my first response would have been to give him a grand jury subpoena. And if he decides to get in front of the grand jury and not cooperate, you hold him in contempt and you send his sorry butt off to jail as well. But But that is just me. So I'm already a little bit agitated because I'm thinking, okay, you've got this 17-year-old kid and his parents who feel comfortable going on television and essentially saying, we're not going to cooperate with somebody who has probably committed treason against the United States. So then I'm getting ready. I'm doing the prep work for the show. And what I do is I go through lots and lots of websites and I look at lots and lots of stories. And typically, I start off by looking at the headline, what's the story about, and then maybe the first couple paragraphs to decide if it's something that would be interesting to discuss with you. So this is a story from USA Today. And we're not going to talk about the substance of the story, but there's something that caught me in the beginning of this. The headline is, it's not safe to be pregnant and black in America. People aren't receiving the care they deserve. Okay, well, it's talking about the racial disparity and, you know, prenatal care for persons of color, which is an interesting story in and of itself, but that's not what we're going to talk about today. So I start to read the story. The nation is grappling with yet another year of alarming surges and widening disparities in maternal mortality. In the United States, mothers and birthing people are dying at higher rates than in other high-income countries, and these deaths are largely preventable. Okay, well, so that's the underlying per point of the story that you could, you know, why is it that in the United States, you know, you have, you know, people dying at higher rates than other income countries? And that might be something that we'll talk about someday, but that's not what got me stuck on this story. Let me read you that sentence again. In the United States, mothers and birthing people are dying at higher rates than in other high-income countries. Mothers and birthing people. What are birthing people? I mean, seriously, how have we gone through this looking glass? I mean, I understand you have transgender issues and that you have biological males who identify as female and vice versa. I understand all that. I'm cool with all that. But the bottom line is, all right, if the bottom line is to give birth, you have to be female. I mean, that's just true. Now, you can be a female that identifies as a male, but, you know, that's the definition of a mother. But we've now gotten to this point where, okay, we have to call people birthing people. I mean, come on. How far through the looking glass do we go? Mothers and birthing people. And this is the USA Today story, because heaven forbid we don't want to just say in the United States, mothers are dying at higher rates than other high-income countries, and these deaths are largely preventable, because, no, we want to make sure that we're inclusive, and so we want to reach out to have birthing people as well. Well, all right, aren't birthing people by definition going to be mothers? Isn't this a redundant term? So I'm now yelling at the computer screen again. It's like, how, birthing people, come on, they're mothers. That's the nature of this. So that's kind of the mood I find myself in today. And then I come across this story. You will remember last spring, and this tends to happen in the spring as schools are getting closer to getting out. You know, everybody's antsy. Everybody's thinking, okay, we want to get on with our summer, et cetera, et cetera. We've got exams coming up. We've got tests coming up. This tends to happen more in the spring than other times. Yesterday in Illinois, 21 Illinois cities, 21 school districts in Illinois cities received swatting calls. Now, everybody, I think, probably knows what swatting calls are. Swatting calls are fake calls to the police involving, in this case, they were involving schools. It means making dangerous and illegal fake calls about an active shooter situation, typically at a school. So, you know, somebody makes the call and says, I'm at ABC High School and there's an active shooter. There's a guy with a gun. I'm at ABC High School and I'm going to shoot this up. You know, so you make these calls. Yesterday in Illinois, 21 separate cities had swatting calls. And I mean, my guess is it's organized. You don't all of a sudden have 21 of these swatting calls that were there. All of them were fake. Now, in some of the school districts, there were, for example, yesterday was a day where they were giving the SAT tests at one of the school districts. And so this was designed to, I mean, clearly sort of disrupt the test. But you get 21 of these calls, all of which were faked. The problem, of course, is when you get one of these calls, all right, you're talking about, especially in today's day and age, you've got an active school shooting situation. And here's what I want to discuss with you. because this is a phenomenon that is happening more and more. You can remember last year in Wisconsin, there were a whole series of like a 2 or 3 day period of time where you had school districts around here and also all over the state that got these similar sort of calls. And it's disruptive. What happens is a typical response by the police is you drop everything. Yeah, and you understand that. It's like, okay, you've got this call. Somebody says there's an active shooting situation in, you know, X high school. Boom. Everybody drops everything, and you rush to the high school, and you find out that it's fake. And that's pretty much what happened yesterday in Illinois. Law enforcement, at least in these 21 different areas, comes to a halt. Everybody drops everything and rushes to the different school, only to find out that, again, it's just one of these sort of pranks, sort of swatting things that are out there. Now, they try to identify who's responsible for this. Part of the problem is, a lot of times, especially with these organized things, it's people from overseas. I think the thing that I saw when they were trying to identify who was doing this in Wisconsin last year is they thought the calls were coming from somebody in England or something like that. And they were these mechanical, you know, these mechanical sort of voices that were there. But this is happening more and more. Big story in the Wall Street Journal talking about how this is happening all over the country, and yesterday was just 21 schools in Illinois. I think it's naive if we don't think that this is going to continue to happen, and it's going to be happening again in Wisconsin. So here's what I want to talk to you about, and I'm not sure I have a really good answer to it. Right now, the response by law enforcement is better safe than sorry. You get this call, active shooter at X high school, boom, everybody drops everything and the SWAT teams head on out. Is that the way we have to continue to respond? Better safe than sorry? Or do we need to have some sort of checkpoint before the police are dispatched? I don't know what that might be. Yeah, a call back. Some sort of way of verifying this before everybody gets sent with the sirens screaming. Now, the downside to that is if it is, in fact, an active shooting situation and you delay, even if it's a delay of 2 or 3 minutes, that can cost people lives. And so you've got that balanced against the fact that the vast majority of these things turn out to be fake. 855-616-1620. That's the WTMJ talk and text line. Better safe than sorry. Or do we need to put in some safeguards, some way of verifying that these are legitimate calls before we drop everybody, everything, and send the sirens over? Where do you come down on this? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. Okay, just to give you some perspective on this, yesterday, 21 separate cities in Illinois got these swatting calls from schools, active shooter situation, all of which were fake. Police responded to reports of shooters in at least 50 schools across New York State on April 4th, at least 36 schools on March 30th. In March, fake reports of school shootings in Iowa were made on a systematic pattern in a single day, hitting at least 30 schools in succession from east to west. So this is the common thing, these systematic hoaxes. And, of course, when it comes in, the police, understandably, they drop everything. All right, and then they rush to the school. It traumatizes the kids, scares the heck out of them, scares the heck out of parents. You've got this freaky sort of thing. Oh, there's a huge police response at XYZ school. It diverts police resources from all sorts of stuff. And I mean, I don't have a good answer to this, but I guess the question becomes, do we need a better way of trying to verify that there really is an active shooter situation before we send all these police resources, knowing that it's going to be a waste and knowing that our chances of catching the creeps that are calling these things in making these phony calls are probably slim to none? 855-616-1620. Let's start with Jim in West Dallas. Jim, you're on WTMJ.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a little bit of experience with the State Patrol. They used to have, before we had seatbelt laws, I was a dispatcher, we used to immediately send out an ambulance to the rollovers. And then once we had the seatbelt law, we didn't have to send out an ambulance because a lot of times the rollovers weren't causing injuries because the seatbelts were creating a safer situation, of course. So if there were some type of system in place in the school where somebody could check and, you know, confirm that there was or wasn't, and called it in and said, yeah, there is, or no, there isn't a situation, there wouldn't have to be this big response. And it would save a bunch of time and you know, maybe,
well,
I don't know how it would work, like you said.
Right. No, thanks for the call, Jim. I guess that's look, and I appreciate it. Look, I get it. I understand the downside of this is if it is the Uvalde situation, I get it. And you have the delay, it could cost lives. At the same time, the reality is, most of these calls are fake calls, and it's a huge drain on resources. It's a huge drain on the psyche of the school administrators and the kids and the parents and the things like that. And it makes you wonder if there's not some way that you could quickly, I mean, obviously you can't take 30 minutes or an hour to decide on this, but some way that you have of, in a matter of moments, trying to verify whether or not this is one of these swatting situations or whether there's really something to this. Because thankfully, the vast majority of these, 99.9%, are going to be fake. And I say thankfully because that means it's not an active shooter situation. Or do we just say, okay, no, we got to be better safe than sorry, so we have to continue to drop everything and respond, even though we know that in almost all the cases, it's going to be fake. Paul on the North Shore. Paul, you're on WTMJ.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, what do you think?
You brought up one of my points about Uvalde. You know, I don't think we have the luxury, because you look at Uvalde, where there was a huge police presence, and everyone will admit that that wasn't handled correctly.
Right.
And then you look at Nashville, where there was a huge police presence. Those three were heralded as heroes, as they should be, and we still lost lives. So I don't think we, and I say we as a society, not law enforcement,
right.
I don't think we are good enough yet to have that luxury of deciding, unfortunately. And yes, resources are compromised, children are scared, but that's where we are in society right now. We don't have the luxury yet to kind of wait and see or give it a 2-minute look over.
Yeah, and I think thanks. And as a result of that, Paul, we're held hostage by the creeps that are out there, by the people overseas or whatever who are getting their kicks out of doing this. Jeff, as a retired police chief, I can tell you that waiting to verify an active shooter before you send a large police response is a catch-22. No matter what you do, you'll look bad. Law enforcement is a results-oriented occupation. People don't care how you obtain a positive outcome, just as long as it's positive. No, I appreciate this, and this isn't and by the way, this isn't a criticism of law enforcement for responding. It's more of an indictment of the system, where you have these creeps that are out there that are doing things like this and are essentially allowed to, by doing this, by making that phone call or whatever, you're allowed to, you know, bring a criminal, law enforcement to a complete standstill, terrorize parents and terrorize kids. 855-616-1620. Jeff, I know a guy who has been swatted 29 times in 9 months. He's been detained at gunpoint in his home. He's had his door kicked in and his wife threatened with arrest. Two local establishments he frequent have also been harassed, indicating a bomb threat yesterday. FBI and local police can't seem to find these creeps or figure out a plan. Then it goes on. Now, this is the latest thing that's out there. Of terrorizing people and things like this, and it's certainly bad when it's directed at individuals, and it's even worse when it's directed collectively at schools. I hate talking about things where I don't have an answer to propose, and I'm not sure I have a good answer to this, other than This is happening. It is a very, very real thing. It's been happening systematically as springtime comes around all across the country. And my guess is, just like last year, it's going to happen again in Wisconsin over the course of the next 6 or 7 weeks. And I just think we've got to come up with some better way than allowing ourselves to be held hostage to these scammers and the swatters and things like that. And that to me is what school officials need to be working with law enforcement, saying, is there something that we can do to protect ourselves from this? Don't have any great ideas on that, but this is a very real problem.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. Sandy Max, that's the visit that we don't typically want to get. It's just our internet guy, Jody, who, you know, in some respects, you always like to see him quickly when there's like a problem. Hey, I got a problem with my computer and stuff, and it's great. He's Johnny on the spot. It's great. When he walks in occasionally when you haven't called him, that's a different story. And so during the news, he actually walked in, and it was either like, is he coming for me or is he coming for you? He was coming for you.
He was coming right for me. And here's how sharp our IT department is. They know without me even being on the computer that somehow I have malware. That the firewall detected. So like, it's serious. But, you know, you immediately, your mind goes to, well, what was I researching for the show? I've been looking up what wildfires are. Right. I've been looking up the Library of Congress songs. Yeah,
right.
Like, I haven't
gone
anywhere
recreational
today.
And of course,
today.
Me, who just is always there, like, pouring, you know, alcohol in the fire, I'm going, oh, where are you going? That's what happens when you visit some of those porn websites and stuff like that. You're like, no, no.
No, I'm not looking for celebrity nudes, nothing like that.
Nothing like
just
that.
Part of the Wisconsin's afternoon news duties.
Absolutely. Well, okay, well, I'm sure, but it actually was. It's kind of like, okay, he's coming for one of the two of us, and it's probably not me, because my office computer is, we have these lockers that you put them in. As mm-hmm. I was telling you, I put mine in there, and I have somehow screwed up it. They're like health club lockers, like you were saying, where you put this code in, and I must have put the code in wrong, because now the thing is locked. I cannot get in it, and so I must have put the wrong code in, and so there's apparently some way that you can...
You're going to have to hack your locker your computer.
Well, right, exactly. I'm thinking about bringing a crowbar and pulling this thing off, and I'm told that there's some way that they can open it, but I haven't reset it, but I haven't gone that route. So my work computer is stuck in this computer there and stuck in this locker there. So
which
it couldn't
could
have
work
been me.
For you on a sunny afternoon. I think that sounds, just leave it there.
It's there, and I have access to all sorts of other computers. So I knew it couldn't be me, because mine has not been turned on. Well, you go see Jody try to figure out like what site you visited that caused this problem.
I'll update you at 1:30. We'll see.
There you go. Okay. It's kind of like that's, there's just all sorts of like calls that you don't want to get, or people that you don't necessarily want to see, not because they're not just wonderful people. They are. Hey, it's great to see you, Jody, but we got a problem here. Okay. All right. I want to revisit something we talked about earlier this week, because it has the potential of happening, particularly if Joe Biden is reelected in 2024. And it is something that will change the way that you go about your daily activities. It is a big deal. And it's happening not through an act of Congress, not through the people that we have elected to office making this decision. It's happening because Joe Biden's Environmental Protection Agency has decided that they want to change the way that you drive. Now, here's the deal, and I always need to do this disclaimer at the beginning. I have no interest right now in an electric vehicle. I don't. About 5% of the new vehicles sold in the United States right now are electric vehicles. And I know that those of you who, or at least several of you who own electric vehicles, love them. I also know a couple people who bought them and who just think it's one of the worst things they did. But that's fine. It's a free market. If you decide that you want to buy an electric vehicle, go with God. I have no problem with that at all. Now, I do have an issue as to whether the taxpayers, the rest of us, should be subsidizing your purchase of a $55,000 or $60,000 electric vehicle. I have issues with taxpayers having to, you know, give you $7,500 in tax credits. And electric vehicles, again, they might be appropriate for some people. I think there's huge practical problems right now. You've got a battery range that typically tops off at about 250 miles. You've got a long charging time. Even rapid chargers take 20 to 30 minutes, which most people don't want to spend. So, I mean, I think electric vehicles are typically best right now for wealthier people who live in urban areas and don't travel long distances. Okay, that's all well and good. If you want an electric vehicle, fine. And I think that there's going to be a time moving forward where the technology makes electric vehicles more competitive, where you get more, you'll get greater capabilities, longer battery life that's out there. You'll have faster charging stations and things like that. So it's not as long as it takes now. But again, I'm not trying to talk you out of buying an electric vehicle. What I object to is the government telling me that I have to buy an electric vehicle. And that is precisely what is going on. If you haven't been paying attention to this, yesterday the Joe Biden Environmental Protection Agency rolled out rules which said essentially that they would be under the Clean Air Act. They're using their authority to regulate tailpipe pollutants. The only way auto manufacturers are going to be able to satisfy these new extremely stringent requirements is essentially to produce more electric vehicles. So essentially, consumers are going to have no choice to buy electric vehicles because there's going to be so few gas-powered vehicles left. These rules go into effect starting 2027, and the idea is, beginning in 2027, these rules will essentially require about 50% of the new vehicles produced to be electric vehicles, and then about 60 to 70% by 2032. So in the next 8 or 9 years, the government is going to force people out of their traditional cars and force them into electric vehicles. Not, again, by forcing the auto manufacturers to not make the cars, but by putting these strict standards in to the point that they just can't do it anymore. It really is very, very much like the old Soviet Union, where, you know, the government set the standards and manufactured the cars, or China now, where, you know, you've got the government which is dictating all these things. And what's so frustrating to me about this is not done through an act of Congress. It's not like our elected representatives have gotten together and said, hey, you know, we want to essentially force the automakers to go to electric vehicles. And so we're going to vote, and we're going to have Congress pass laws, and we're going to do this. This is the bureaucrats at the EPA, under the direction of Joe Biden, saying, all right, this is what we're going to do, without any consideration at all, by the way, of where the power is going to come from. You know, the electric grid, which is testy at best now, how is the electric power grid going to produce enough electricity so that we go from 5% of the vehicles, new vehicles on the road, to 50%? How are they going to do that over the course of the next 5 or 6 years? Are we going to do nuclear power? Where is this electricity going to come from to do it? How are people going to retrofit their homes? But again, it's not the free market operating. It's not individual choice. It's big government telling you that this is what you're going to have to do through its rulemaking power. And let's face it, the bottom line of all this is it's not going to make a whit of difference to global climate change at all, because China is industrializing. They're building gas and they're using coal power plants. India is doing this. So we're doing all this stuff, if this in fact happens. And we're doing it, and it's not going to make any material difference in the quality of air to begin with. But the bigger point is, you are no longer going to have de facto the choice of buying an internal combustion engine car. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the WTMJ talk and text line. Again, if you want to buy an electric vehicle, that's fine. Like I say, I know people that love them, and that's great. Most of the people that I know that have them do use it as a second or a third car, kind of what I would describe as sort of a plaything to kind of like tool around town, run sort of errands, because even the people I know that love them generally agree that they're not practical to take on long drives and things like that. But again, if you want to buy one, you know, buy one. I'm okay with that. But what do you think about the government essentially forcing you? And this is 2023. This is going to start in 2027. This is going to start in the next 3 or 4 years. You are effectively going to be very, very limited if you try to buy a car with an internal combustion engine in it, because the auto manufacturers are not going to be able to produce them because of this government rule. And those of you who do still want to buy an internal combustion engine vehicle for whatever reasons, you're going to find, my guess is, because the supply is so limited, you're going to, if you think you're paying a lot for a car now, just wait. 855-616-1620. I'm sorry. This is a major government overreach. It is wrong. It needs to be stopped. There will, of course, be lawsuits. But I guess the only way to really stop this is for Joe Biden to be defeated if he runs again for reelection in 2024. Because if you have a Republican who takes over, they can at least roll back these EPA rules. Whatever the bureaucrats put in place can, in fact, be undone, which is another reason why it shouldn't be done by bureaucrats. It should be, if we're going to make this decision, it should be an act of Congress. 855-616-1620. Are you willing to give up or not be able to replace your internal combustion car over the course of the next couple years? 855-616-1620. We discuss. 855-616-1620. One of our texters, you're just a chicken little about this. Nobody's making you buy an electric car. Oh, no, you are. Because what the government is doing by these incredibly strict standards, and they're doing it on purpose. This is not about the climate. This is about forcing people out of their automobiles. Yes, the government is going to be making you buy an electric vehicle because by imposing these different requirements, automakers aren't going to make conventional cars anymore. You're not going to have that choice. And if Congress wants to do it, that's fine. But this is Joe Biden giving in to the climate extremists. And it's not going to make any difference, like I say, because India's got their coal-powered plants. You've got China that's doing this. And yet we're going to be stuck in these expensive electric vehicles way before the technology is there. Now, if you want to buy one, again, don't send me the text saying, I love my electric vehicle. 5% of the new cars that are sold this year are electric vehicles. Fine. That's great. You want the electric vehicle? That's super. Now, explain to me again where we're going to get the power that's going to charge all these things when it's more than just kind of a real niche. Nobody's able to answer that question. Explain to me how, as a practical matter, people who drive long distances, not the people that putt-putt around the area, how you're going to do this. What is this going to do when you're driving from Milwaukee to Florida and you've got to hopefully find a charging station and then sit for a couple hours waiting for it to charge? What's going to happen with individuals? How are you going to retrofit your homes to have the charging stations? Maybe at some point in time in the future, we're going to be ready for this, and the free market will dictate it. And I'm not telling you, if you want an electric vehicle, you shouldn't be able to buy it, but I think it's wrong for the government, in this case, the EPA, to decide we've declared war on the internal combustion engine and we're just going to go ahead and impose these rules. Again, the only benefit is if the EPA imposes the rules, whatever the bureaucrats do can be undone by a new set of bureaucrats. Jeff, this is extremely stupid because they don't have charging centers for the cars in place along long rides. They also haven't considered how those cars will be charged, which is still fossil fuels within generators. I drive more than 250 miles per day, which means I can't make it through my day without recharging. Yeah, I have a friend of mine who has an electric vehicle, and they typically take it down to Chicago. They babysit for their grandkids, and they can't get from where they live in Wisconsin down to Chicago and back on a charge. They can't do that. So they have to, I think they were telling me the story about how they have to stop at Woodman's somewhere along the way, and they have to wait, you know, 40 minutes, 50 minutes, an hour to charge the car enough to get it home. I'm sorry, that's just not practical for most people. You know, there's no question about that. Jeff, we have a cabin in Wyoming with no electricity. There may never be electricity way up high in rural areas. We can't drive an electric vehicle up there. We'd be stuck there forever. Well, I think that's it. Jeff, if Biden does this, and he is going to do this, whoever runs against him should make that their campaign. If you want to keep your car, if you want to be able to afford to drive, vote for me. I think that's it. Jeff, Toyota Motor Company has already said no to electric. They have said, we do not have the infrastructure to deal with the charging requirements, even if we went all electric. Yeah, I mean, there are all these issues that are out there, and it's a supply and demand thing. At some point in time, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, the free market is going to dictate that electric vehicles make sense. But that's, we're not close to that now. But this is one of these sort of pie in the sky things that are out there forcing you into doing this. Jeff, you might as well raise the age to get a driver's license to 35, because no one under that age is going to be able to afford a vehicle. Well, I mean, that might be part of the thing, too. We want to try to force people into mass transit. Jeff, doesn't Joe Biden know that many people in the country live in rural or mountainous areas that are miles and miles away from town, so the charging stations cannot possibly help this part of the population? Yes, Jeff, my wife and I can't afford a new car now. This will force people into giving up cars and into mass transit. That is the woke mob's end game here. Then you are controlled as to when you can travel. Suburbia will be killed by this. Rural areas don't stand a chance. Well, look, it's just, this is the reality that's going on. And I bring this up because, again, I come this way but once. This is a big, big deal. And because you've got a mainstream media which is aligned with this idea, it's not getting the play that it deserves. The fact that by 2027, which is coming up pretty soon, you know, they want half of the vehicles to be electric. Well, explain to me how that's going to work. But nobody asks these questions. Story I'm looking at the New York Times about this today says, well, It's nothing to worry because you know, if you're buying a car, you know, right now, you don't have to worry about it. Well, okay, this is 2023. What if your internal combustion car is going to need to be replaced in the next couple years? Well, then you darn sure better worry about it, because 2027 is coming quickly, and 2032 is coming even more quickly than that. So you have been warned. This is a very, very big deal, and one of our texters was saying, I can't wait to start to watch the NASCAR all-electric races, stock car races. Yep, that's Joe Biden for you. Join WTMJ as we support the Brewers Community Foundation benefiting the Wisconsin Humane Society. Thursday, April 20th, in the parking lot of American Family Field, the Brewers will be accepting donations to benefit those pets sheltered at the Humane Society. It's really a great cause. Blankets, towels, beds, food, etc. No matter how small the donation, anything helps. Donations start at 7 a.m. Again, that's coming up a week from today. April 20th, Thursday, April 20th, the Brewers will also be accepting donations inside American Family Field during their homestand against the Red Sox, which starts April 21st, Friday, a week from today. You know, it's one of the cool things about this baseball season, and I say this from the perspective of a baseball fan, but also, you know, I think we got a 20-game season ticket package. In years past, the way it worked is, they played an unbalanced schedule. By that, you played, it seemed like all the time they were playing games against the rivals in their immediate division, the Chicago Cubs and the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Reds and the Cardinals. And, you know, it seemed like four or five times a year, every time you'd go to a game, it would be, you know, one of those teams. And that's all well and good. This year, they've gone to a balanced schedule where they play every team in Major League Baseball. Everybody from the American League, everybody from the National League. They still play the Cubs and the Cardinals more, but it's not so unbalanced. So, for example, this road trip, you know, the Brewers just finished with Arizona. They're going to San Diego, and then they're going up to Seattle, which is an American League team. They're going to play three games in Seattle. Next year, they will play Seattle at American Family Field. So every other year, you're going to have a chance to get to see every American League team. And like this year, for example, it's the Red Sox. And I think that's going to be cool. I'm looking forward to that. I think we've got tickets for that a week from Friday, the 21st. I think I've got tickets to go see the Red Sox. Looking forward to that. Okay, so here's my question. Why does State Senator Dewey Strobel, who's from, you know, kind of the Ozaukee County area, you know, why does he hate kids? Oh no. Well, what do you mean? How he hates kids? Well, he's on the joint finance committee, and you know, he has taken a position which I, by the way, agree with. And it's just, I guess the argument is that, hey, if you take this position, you must in fact hate children. So let's discuss this as part of his budget. Tony Evers wants to take $120 million in taxpayer money. And what he wants to do is he wants to fund free school breakfasts and lunches for all Wisconsin school children. For all Wisconsin school children. Now, the way it works now is that if you qualify for, you know, free lunches, and it's all based on income level. So, you know, roughly, I got the numbers here. If your family has an income of under like $31,000 for the under $36,000 a year family income, kids get free school lunches, no questions asked. Okay. If you are from families that make up to $51,000 a year, that difference between 36 and 51, you qualify for reduced price lunches, which are very, very cheap. Okay, that's it. But if your family makes more than $51,000 a year, you are expected to do one of two things. Either mom and dad, or the kid, you know, has to make their lunch, make their bag lunch. And heaven forbid, this is, I don't know about you, but this is, you know, when I went to school, this is what it was. You know, my mom would make my lunch, and then I reached a certain age, and then I would make my lunch. And you had a little paper bag, and you'd have the sandwich, and you'd have some potato chips and an apple or whatever, and you'd pack your own lunch, and you'd take it to school, and you would eat it. But there wasn't an expectation that the taxpayers would be picking up the tab for that. Alternatively, if you don't want to make your own lunches, or you don't want to take the time to, you know, go out and buy the lunch meat, or you don't want to go through the effort of doing that, all right, there's the hot lunches that are available, but it's the idea that you pay for them if you have the ability to do that. So nobody, and I always preface this when we have this conversation, nobody is suggesting that the kids who cannot afford because of this financial limit to pay for their lunches, or that the kids who qualify for the reduced price lunches, nobody is suggesting that those kids should not continue to get the free lunches. The question is whether or not we should take $120 million in taxpayer dollars and use it to do what Evers wants to do, which is to provide free lunches to all kids, regardless of whether or not the parents have the ability to pay. Now, I bring up Dewey Strobel because the state senator, he's, you know, part of the Joint Finance Committee, and I'm looking at a story where he says, and look, I hope you're sitting down for this, because I understand this is going to upset some people. He says that families who are able to pay for their kids' lunches should pay for their kids' lunches. Let me read that again. That's Dewey Strobel, Cedarburg, says families that are able to pay for their kids' lunches should pay for their kids' lunches. Oh my God. Can you imagine that? How you know, why do you hate children? Why do you hate children when you say that people who have the ability to pay for their kids' lunches should pay for their kids' lunches? Now, there's a huge push that, of course, is going on to move away from this. And the idea is, well, you know, if you don't just give the free lunches to everybody, there might be kids that come in and, you know, they don't have the bag lunches because the parents haven't made them or they haven't made them. Or the parents have forgotten to put or neglected to put the money into their school account, so they're running a deficit. We need to bring back free meals because we want to make sure that the government is providing every kid who wants food with food. Our number, 855-616-1620. That's a WTMJ talk and text line. All right. I mean, is it unreasonable to say to people that if you can afford to provide, I don't know, food for your child, a lunch for your child, that you should have an obligation to do that? Is it truly the responsibility of the taxpayers to, I mean, feed people's children regardless of whether or not they have the wherewithal to do it themselves? So if you are, I don't know, a retiree on a fixed income, for example, is it your job to pay for the lunch of, I don't know, two parents who, you know, have an income of 150 grand that live in your school district? I mean, is that really where we have come to this? You know, do we now need the taxpayers to pick up the tab for every child? If you want to talk about raising the limits, if you want to argue, well, I think $36,000 is too low, maybe we should give free lunches to kids who make $40,000, and maybe we should raise the reduced range to 60 grand. That's one thing. But that's not what Evers is talking about. It's free lunches for everybody. 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. Jeff, I'm retired. Who's paying for my lunch? Well, not only is the government not paying for your lunch, but the government is expecting you to pay for the lunch of, I don't know, the kids of, let's say, two doctors who are pulling in 300 grand or more a year. You're expected to pay for their kids' lunches. Where did we get to this stage? And again, this is not a conversation about if you've got people who qualify economically for reduced prices or free lunches. This is about people, kids who come from families with means, who have the sufficient means to provide either to make their kids' lunches or to pay for their kids' lunches, but this idea that somehow it became the taxpayers' responsibility to do it. Get a couple texts from people saying, well, gee, with all the money we pee away here, why not do this? Well, if that's going to be your category, then we're just full-out socialism. Let's just have the government take care of everything. Don't you think this is worthwhile? Well, why do we stop at lunches? Why don't we just have the government provide meals for everybody that wants one of those? Jeff, taxpayer school lunch funded school lunches are ridiculous. Some, of course, not all families that take advantage of this are spending their discretionary income on other things instead of paying for their kids' lunches. Well, if you qualify economically, it's fine. And if you want to argue that we should up the level, I'm cool with that. I'm cool with that. Maybe we do need to reassess, and maybe free lunches should be, the threshold should be 40 grand instead of 36. I'm willing for that conversation, but I'm sorry, you're never going to convince me that, I don't know, the family that is pulling in over 100 grand a year should have the taxpayers that are paying to feed their kids. It's just not right. Let's talk to John in De Pere. John, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, John.
Long-time listener. Always enjoy your show.
Thank you, sir.
You know, we're a nation that we take care of people when they need it.
Yes.
And that's great, and that's what we should do. You know, but when you don't need it and you're provided with, you know, you lose value in it. There's no value in that. If you can afford to, and when I went to high school a long time ago, kind of around when you did, we had an open campus. So, a lot of times you went out for lunch. The school still has to prepare meals, assuming all these people are going to eat it. Right, and so there's going to be a lot of waste. What do they do? They just throw it in the dumpster, So I think you need to think about that also.
Well, right. No, thanks for the call. And again, this is I'm getting some of these texts that say, well, why do you hate kids and things like that? It's not that at all. It's a question of basic responsibility. And you are, I could not agree with you more, John. The idea is we in society have an obligation to provide help and assistance to those among us who are the least fortunate. And that's not what this is all about. This is about mom and dad just decide that, well, I don't want to pay for my kid's lunch, or I don't want to take the time to make the bag lunch or whatever. So somebody else then has the responsibility of paying for that. And to me, you bring a child into this world, you do have certain responsibilities, and one of those would be feeding the kid. If not, why don't we just say, here, you know, forget just the Monday through Friday free lunches. Here, we're going to have free breakfast. We're going to have free lunches. We're going to have free dinners for everybody. We're going to have giant government communal halls where we feed the people. And if you don't like that, why do you hate children? Why should we expect parents to feed their children when they have the financial means to do it? Margaret in Milwaukee. Margaret, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I worked for food service for about 20 years for MPS. I retired about 13 years ago, however. I also have seen the decline of the food quality that is put out by Milwaukee Public Schools. We prepared our food years ago. Before I retired, the food was all brought in, and it really It wasn't attractive.
It was not. I was going to say it was not appealing. Okay, got it.
It was not appealing. I watched more food get dumped than eaten year after year.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean I think. Go ahead, Margaret. I'm sorry.
I really don't. Everybody should be free, and I really don't think that everybody should pay. But there's got to be a happy medium somewhere, and we can't compare Milwaukee Public Schools to schools in Cedarburg because it just doesn't.
Right. Well,
there's no comparison.
Yeah. No. Thanks for calling, Mark. Now, matter of fact, I don't even think we're talking about MPS because I'm willing to be corrected, but I think I'm right about this. I think MPS is free lunches all around, regardless of income, because my understanding is that, you know, if a certain percentage of the population, the student body, qualifies for the free lunches, then everybody gets the free lunches. But that's okay. Again, I'm not arguing for making this more restrictive. But again, let's take an area like Ozaukee County, or, you know, some of the other areas that are around there, some of the other school districts. I mean, look at the kids from River Hills or something, okay, where, you know, they're sending the kids to public schools and the parents are from, you know, living in homes that are, you know, $500,000, $1 million, $2 million. Why in God's green earth should other taxpayers be picking up the tab for free lunches for those kids? It is one of these bizarre sort of things that's out there because, again, it's this idea that it sounds good, and if you don't want this, what you're really saying is that you don't, you know, you hate kids. No, it's not about that at all. It's about there are certain basic fundamental responsibilities that government has and, you know, the government should be doing, but when did it become the responsibility of the taxpayers to pick up the tab for, again, in this case, you know, the lunches that are provided to kids who come from families that have a lot more income than many of the taxpayers do? Very, very frustrating.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the program. All right. 103rd and Silver Spring. That is the site of the now defunct Walmart. Remember, a big Walmart store, and Walmart closed, I think, last month or so. Closed because it was a theft problem. That's it. And just like Walmart's closed four locations in Chicago, effective, I think, this week, Walmart reaches a point where if the stores are not profitable, and a lot of times the reason it's not profitable is because they're just decimated with theft, what they do is they close the stores. And then you get the elected officials that get all upset about that. But the bottom line is it is a business. And, you know, Walmart is not a philanthropic enterprise. And if they can't make money and they make a profit, then you close the stores. And for the elected officials, for example, who denounce Walmart, and I'm not a huge fan of Walmart, don't get me wrong, but who are complaining about, well, the Walmart closed, maybe what they should really be complaining about and taking an inside look is, how did you let the neighborhoods deteriorate to that point, or why is it that we've been unable to, you know, stop people from shoplifting? And of course, that answer comes back to the uncomfortable truth that we do a lousy job in many cases of holding people accountable for their criminal acts. And this is inevitably what happens if you let shoplifting get out of control. What's going to happen is the businesses are going to end up closing, which is maybe a reason why, you know, you should treat things like shoplifting and other stuff like a big deal. Anyhow, that's the background. That parking lot, and if you can't picture it, it was a big Walmart store, and it's a huge parking lot. And what's happened is it's apparently become one of these areas where people go to hang out, especially once the weather gets warm. So Monday night, they had more than 200 cars. More than 200 cars. Probably more than had been in the Walmart for a long time. 200 cars loitering, blasting loud music, and doing spin-outs. So essentially, it was kind of taken over by one of these sort of flash mobs that were there. Police say that there were 36 traffic stops, 50 citations, 4 arrests, and 4 towed vehicles after Monday night's gathering. And what they're saying is that these are these takeovers that are fueled by social media. And so the other day, there was a press conference, and the mayor and the police chief say, okay, here's the deal. You know, we're not going to tolerate this, and we're going to be aggressive in cracking down on this sort of activity. And like I say, 50 citations, 36 traffic stops, 4 arrests. They also recovered a handgun and towed 4 vehicles, which is all well and good that they, you know, cracked down on that. There was also another example, Midtown Center in the old kind of Capitol Court area, where they had 300 shots that were fired at a gathering at the Midtown Center. So you have one of these examples after another where people are just in these flash mobs that they are descending and they're creating problems. Now, I was thinking about this because remember last year you had the incidents in the Deer District downtown where you had the shootings in the Deer District area, like on Water Street, and you had, in some cases, many of the same subjects who, you know, came out and had this similar press conference about how, you know, we're not going to tolerate this and we're going to crack down on this and, you know, we're going to impose a youth curfew and we're going to go ahead and we're going to go after the parents as well and we're going to fine them. And I think the last time I checked, when somebody had made an open records request about, okay, how many citations, curfew violations had there been? And it was like a half dozen or something like that. So it was completely and totally lip service that was done to this. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the WTMJ talk and text line. All right, so the mayor and the police chief are out there saying we're going to aggressively crack down on these flash mobs. And they say, look, we made 36 traffic stops. We issued 50 citations. Now, of course, the citations, you know what probably happens. The people get the citations. They look at them. They ball them up. They throw them in the back seat of the car, and that's it. Because my guess is a lot of the people that got citations for being in that parking lot probably don't have driver's licenses, or if they do, they're suspended licenses or something like that. They made 4 arrests, they recovered a handgun, they towed 4 vehicles. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the WTMJ talk and text line. All right, here is my question. As we move into the summer and more of this stuff happens, do you think authorities are serious about this? Or is this just lip service? Last year, like I say, when you had the stuff going on in Water Street and all, we were told, okay, we're going to crack down, we're going to use our curfew violations, we're going to be aggressive with this, and they didn't. They just, no sooner were those words out of officials' mouths, than they just kind of floated up into the air, and nobody did anything about it. Now we're starting to see this, and this happens when the weather gets nice. You know, it happens at the lakefront. Remember, you know, a few years ago, you had a lakefront that was just completely out of control until the sheriff's department started cracking down on that. All right, will there be follow-through? 855-616-1620. That's the WTMJ talk and text line. And my answer is, I hope so. Because, I mean, again, this to me is a quality of life sort of thing. You cannot have these large flash mobs that just go out and take over these areas. You can't. But at the same time, I don't know, four arrests out of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people, that doesn't seem to be a lot to me. They recovered a handgun. They towed four vehicles. My guess is if you went out there and you were really aggressive, what you would find is a lot of the vehicles were perhaps stolen. What you would find probably is a lot more than one simple handgun. So the question is, you know, do we want law enforcement to be aggressive, and will they be aggressive? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. Let's start with Glenn in Bayview. Glenn, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This has to be a whole systemic approach. You just can't have, you know, the police saying this or the politicians saying this or the district attorney, frankly, not saying something. Mm-hmm. And the parents. Everybody has to have skin in the game. The politicians have to make sure that the police are doing their job and the district attorney is doing his job and holding the parents accountable. Seeing these kids that are 12, 13 years old that are getting killed at 3 o'clock in the morning tells me that something is missing here. And I'm not crazy about Rudy Giuliani as a, you know, where he's gone, but his old broken windows approach to law enforcement did an awful lot for you, New York City. And, you know, maybe we ought to start looking at those kind of methods.
Yeah.
The other thing is they don't allow the police to bring their dogs out that can sense dogs, I mean, sense gun oil to this type of thing because it's considered not politically correct.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's uncuff our police and let them do their job.
Well, Glenn, you know, thanks for calling. You know, see, you hit on something because I thought it was interesting that you had the mayor there and the police chief there. And I by the way, I like the police chief. I think he's doing the best he can under difficult circumstances. But this press conference they had the other day reminded me again of what happened in the Deer District last year, where we're cracking down on curfew, and we're going to do this, and then it never happened. They just never did this. It would have been, I think, really good. You make a good point. Where was John Chisholm? Wouldn't it be good to have the district attorney and maybe even the city attorney there? And they say, we're on board with this. You know, we're not going to tolerate this. And here is what we're really going to do. Okay, when these things occur, we are going to be prepared. We're going to have a response. And then here's what we're going to do. We're going to, if you're illegally in these areas and you're creating these problems and these disruptions, okay, we're going to start running license plates. How many cars do you think were there that were probably stolen? You know, how many people that were at this thing really did have guns? You know, and they find one gun, they tow four vehicles. My guess is if you would just untether the police and say, this is going to be a priority, but then to your point, you need it to be, I guess, holistic would be the good word. You need the district attorney to say, yeah, okay, here's what the deal is. You know, when you have a bunch of people, 200-300 people that descend in this lot and they're engaging in disorderly conduct, we're write the citations, give them the charges, and we're going to prosecute this. Wouldn't that be unique? And when you arrest people, if you're taking into custody for disorderly conduct and you're impounding their vehicles and we find guns in the car, well, okay, then we're going to charge them with that. And if it turns out, like you know it will, that a lot of people that are participating in this have criminal records and aren't legally allowed to carry the guns, we're going to prosecute them for this as well. Now, you know that that's going to be controversial because the minute you do that, what's going to happen is, oh, you're arresting too many of this type of person or that type of person. But otherwise, it's just lip service. I guarantee you, if you go in and you start aggressively making arrests, and then you have a district attorney that's willing to follow up on this, and I'm not saying trample on civil liberties, but you know, if you pull up in this parking lot and you've got a bunch of people who are loitering and they're engaging in disorderly conduct or whatever, and you've got the authority to make arrests and start seizing the cars and see what you find in the cars, because you know it's going to be a lot of contraband, and then have the follow-up. You do that once or twice or three times, and this flash mob stuff is going to stop. Because a lot of the people that are going to be doing this, well, first of all, they're going to be off the streets and they're not going to be in a position to do it. But secondly, the word's going to get out that, hey, if I show up at this thing, the cops may very well be there. And next thing I know, my car is going to get towed. And best case scenario, I'm going to have to come up with however many $100 you need to do it. So I think, you know, Cavalier Johnson, the mayor, and the police chief are saying the right things. Okay, we're not going to tolerate this. We're going to crack down on disruptive activities, to which I say go with God. I'm just a little bit skeptical about whether there is going to be the real follow-through on that. And if you're not going to follow through with it, then you shouldn't be saying it. Mike on the Northwest Side. Mike, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Yeah, I agree with everything you guys have said just before. But to enhance the police enforcement, I would suggest having stop sticks in these entrances and exits. So these guys, if they try to get away or try, you know, whatever they're doing, if they don't pay the citation, they got busted tires to pay for.
Exactly. No, I agree with you. You've got to be aggressive with this. And I guess I was trying to, during the break, I was trying to look up, because this happens at the lakefront, you know, and we've had it happen in the past where the areas down along the beachfront and stuff on warm summer days, they get taken over by the cruisers and the parkers, and there's problems like that. And, you know, you had a conscious effort that the sheriff's department made a few years back, and they said, okay, we're going to be aggressive about this, and we're not going to allow this to happen. And they ended up making a whole bunch of arrests. But you know what? They stopped the problem. And unless you're going to be aggressive about that, it's going to continue to be a problem. Now, I understand it's a little bit difficult because now with social media, you have these flash mobs. It's not just, hey, we're going to go cruise Highway 100. It's, all right, this is where we're all going to go. But, you know, the police have intelligence officers, too, that monitor these things, so you know where this stuff is going to be, so you can at least maybe plan accordingly, at least to an extent. Jeff, law enforcement is laughed at when the charges are dropped, penalties are non-existent, and laws are merely suggestions. The good people of these neighborhoods have no hope. That's why it would have been refreshing to see, if not John Chisholm, who's willing to come out and show his face in public, at least somebody from the DA's office and somebody from the city attorney's office who would say, look, we're on board with this as well. We're on board with this. You know, if you're going to issue tickets for curfew violations like they talked about last spring, you know, somebody from the DA's office or, for in that case, the city attorney's office said, yeah, and we're going to enforce these. You know, we're going to say, yeah, do it. And then we're going to back this up by being aggressive. And, you know, and if it's a 15-year-old kid, we're going to go after the parents as well. If you're going to say these things, be willing to follow up. And my concern is that there's not going to be any follow-up. Hope I'm wrong. I really do, because this is a major quality of life thing. Moreover, I think if you're aggressive with stuff like this, my guess is if you were even more aggressive, you would be able to find all sorts of serious criminal violations that were occurring in this flash mob beyond just one handgun, towing four vehicles, and making four arrests. My guess is there's a lot more people that could well have been arrested, but unless you've got the DA's office on board to follow up with the prosecutions, it all becomes, you know, an exercise in futility. All right, story in the local newspaper. And I don't take an issue with it, but if you're going to do it, I have a suggestion for a way to do this better. The best $100, actually $200, because I did this for both my wife and myself, the best $200 I've spent in years has come with getting these global entry forms, which it's a card you get. And it allows you to, it's like TSA PreCheck, so you can get in that line domestically. You can go through the line, so you don't have to take your shoes off. You don't have to, you know, pull your computer out of the bags. It's wonderful. And it has global entry, has the added value of being international. So if you're ever flying back into the United States and you're coming through customs, and you've ever come through customs in Chicago, you know it can be just a nightmare. But if you've got the global entry card, you shave, trust me, you shave a lot of time off of that. Global entry costs $100, and you got to go down. I think the cards are good for like 5 years, and you have to, and you can then I think renew them online. And you got to go down for an interview with Homeland Security. That's $100. Now the Journal Sentinel is talking about how this week travelers are going to be able to sign up for TSA PreCheck at the Milwaukee airport, and they have this mobile enrollment. TSA PreCheck is great as far as it goes. TSA PreCheck is $78 for 5 years, but TSA PreCheck doesn't have all the things that Global Entry has. TSA PreCheck is fine if you're never going to travel outside the country. All right, that's fine. And if you know that, my only advice is this is a great thing. If there's any chance that you're going to travel outside of the country, my advice is it's a little bit more of a hassle, but spend the extra $22, go through the process to get the Global Entry card, because trust me, the first time you are coming back through customs, you will say, that's the best money that I have ever spent at all. So TSA PreCheck is fine, and they're making it easier for you to get that, and the story in the paper, you know, talks about that. But I would say go through the extra hassle, spend the extra $20, get yourself, do what you have to do to get yourself that Global Entry card. You will thank me if in the next 5 years you are ever coming back into the country. You'll say, I remember that radio guy, and I'm looking at that big customs line that hundreds and hundreds or thousands of people are in, and I get to bypass most of that all because I spent that extra $22. So if you're asking me, TSA PreCheck is fine. Go with Global Entry. It will make your life so much better. Do you fly much?
Me?
Yeah.
I used to when I was flying cross-country to go from where I lived in San Francisco to where I went to school in Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
Don't fly as much now.
Okay. You know, this TSA PreCheck or the Global Entry, have you ever sprung for that?
I have not. I have been able to benefit from our family friends sometimes when we use tickets that they bought. They have TSA PreCheck, so I know how good it is. I actually went through Chicago Customs, like you were saying, coming back from England in March 2020.
Oh,
I was studying abroad and had to come back due to COVID. So it was definitely an experience.
We'll put that in quotation marks. If you believe nothing else I tell you, and all the time we know each other, trust me, and if you're going to go that route, if there's any chance you're going overseas, spend the $100. It's a little bit more of a hassle to get it than the TSA PreCheck, because you got to go down to TSA and you got to go through an interview. So it's a little bit more of a hassle, but the Global Entry has everything that the TSA PreCheck does, plus it gets you into the country. If you ever need it, you will thank me. It is the best $100 that my wife and I have ever spent.
If I ever become an international traveler, I'll definitely remember to do it.
That's it. That's just sort of my advice. And, you know, we're not ready to roll it out quite yet, but I think there's going to be at least one more, you know, Jeff and Fran Wagner cruise that's coming up at some point in time. And so just giving everybody that extra notice, go with the Global Entry thing. It is well worth it. When we come back, do you care who tells you about the weather on TV? Stick around. A couple people are saying, what is this Global Entry thing? Okay, here's it. Global Entry is TSA PreCheck allows you to travel domestically, and you can go into that special line and you can, you know, bypass things and all. It's very, very good. So, but it's only domestic. You know, you don't have to take your shoes off. You don't have to take your computer out of the bags. But again, it is only domestic. It costs like $78. It's good for 5 years, and you can get it remotely now. They've got this program down at the airport, and it's fine for people who choose to do that. No issue at all. Global Entry has everything the TSA PreCheck has, and it includes international travel as well. So, I mean, I've got a Global Entry card. So when I'm flying from Milwaukee to Florida, you know, you have the TSA PreCheck. You pull out your Global Entry card. You have it registered with the airlines. You always get that TSA PreCheck. So if you've got Global Entry, you've got everything you would get with TSA PreCheck, plus when you are traveling internationally, you get to go into the fast lane coming through customs, which is very, very much, it's worth it. So that's what I always tell people. And, my understanding is there's a little bit of a backlog to get, you got to have an interview. Once you get the card, it's good for 5 years and you have to renew it. I haven't renewed ours yet because they're not coming due for a while, but for most people, you can renew it online, so you don't have to go through the process. So if you're, I guess, thinking that there's any chance that you're going to travel internationally, it's worth pursuing this, and you might have a backlog before you can hit the interviews. I don't know, but I'm just saying that if you're going to get the TSA pre-check thing, to me, if there's any chance at all that you might be traveling internationally, it's well worth the extra $22. So, because global entry is everything the TSA pre-check is, plus it is also the international travel. And trust me, you will want that. you will want that. All right, the interesting story, and I'm fascinated by how we consume media. There's a story in the, it's actually a number of sources. There's a meteorologist, I do not know her, Marissa Walzen, who's been at Channel 4 for like 2 years. She's been there since January of 2021. She's originally from the Detroit area. She was out in Eugene, Oregon for a number of years, came back and has been working at Channel 4 for 2 years, and they're announcing that she's leaving Channel 4 and she's got a gig with a, job in Detroit, which is kind of her hometown. So that's kind of that it's a bigger market, career progression. You see that. So she's been at TMJ4 for two years, and she's leaving, and it's getting some attention. I always find myself wondering though how we consume media, and particularly like TV news, and by that I mean there was a time when I was growing up, where you had these dominant, there was Walter Cronkite, and there was Huntley and Brinkley, you know, and you would know like a handful of the reporters that, for example, were doing the reporting, and people would tune in to see the reporters. I want to see Walter Cronkite, and that was true to an extent on the local news as well. I think that's kind of changed over the years. And this is my question. I was thinking about this with the announcement that this woman is leaving TMJ4. How important are the reporters? How important are the weather forecasters, the meteorologists, in deciding what station you're going to watch? Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the WTMJ talk and text line. I mean, I understand that there might be something when you're looking at the news anchors. Gee, I love Charles Benson. Gee, I love Carol Meekins, etc. You know, we want to watch them. But as far as the reporters and the meteorologists and things like that, and in a market like Milwaukee, what happens is we're a mid-sized market. And what happens is a lot of times you'll have people who, starting their career, they'll start at a small market, and then they'll end up at a medium-sized market like Milwaukee, and then a lot of them will leave, and they'll try to go to Chicago or a bigger market. That's kind of the way the progression works. Some people end up staying because it's home, and so Milwaukee is where I want to be because Milwaukee is where I grew up, so I worked in South Dakota, I worked in Sioux Falls, and then I worked somewhere else, and now I'm here, I'm going to stay. But a lot of times, you know, people tend to transition through these different markets because you work in a bigger market, you make a little bit more money. And I've always found myself wondering, when you have this turnover, and sometimes it's greater at stations than others, when you have the people leaving and you've got a new set of reporters coming in, does that really affect an impact on how people are watching the news? 855-616-1620. How important are the reporters, the meteorologists, in deciding whether you're going to watch a particular station or not? 855-616-1620. It's fascinating. People are all over the map on this. One of our texters says, hey, they grew up watching Channel 4, and so it doesn't matter who's delivering the news. It's just Channel 4 has been, you know, where they watch. Somebody else says, I wake up to Fox 6 every morning. When anchors or reporters leave, it's a bit of adjustment, but I stay loyal to Fox 6. So, I mean, I am intrigued, and what got me thinking about it, this meteorologist who's been in Channel 4 for 2 years is leaving. You know, do we tune in and do we watch it because of the reporters and the personalities, or is it just, hey, we like the style that these have? And it's, I think, particularly relevant in a market like this where on TV we tend to have a degree of turnover. You know, people start at the smaller markets, they come to a mid-sized market, and then a lot of them, particularly if they're not from here, you know, look for, hey, we've got to go to Chicago, I can make more money, or go to Detroit or wherever. Let's start with Mike in Mequon. Mike, you're on WTMJ.
There are three factors for me. Their voice is one factor. There's one of the channels, the weathercaster is so loud, I have to literally turn down the television set, and I have hearing problems, and my wife feels the same way. Their appearance, I know that sounds shallow, but...
Well, it is what it is, you know.
The male or female is very important to me. And their age, and their, you know, how long they've been with a particular... I'm used to... Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember Bill Carlson and Judy Marks. And that.
Oh, you're really you're dating yourself there, Mike. Absolutely, sure.
I am dating. I am dating myself. But the truth is, somebody who you feel comfortable with, you know, so these people who come and go, it's hard to adjust to that. It really, and so unless they bring somebody on who's so much better,
yeah.
I find myself maybe turning channels on that.
Interesting. No, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. It's you know, I think it varies, and especially there is more of a turnover nowadays, particularly when, again, we're talking about the reporters as opposed to, you know, the anchors. Let's talk to Tom in Hartford. Tom, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hi, Jeff. Love your show.
Thank you, sir.
I like Mark Baden, Channel 12. Well, I like Channel 12 News. I listen to all the newses throughout the years. But one thing about Mark, if he's wrong the next day or something like that, he apologizes for it.
Yeah.
And he's been around a long time. I just like how he gives the weather, and I like the news on the station. But I did watch other stations. I've been around a long time.
Yeah,
I've been listening to TNT 1960.
Oh, well, Tom, thanks for... Thanks. We appreciate that. You know, and I guess that now some people are saying, well, it's important on the radio. Well, there are differences. I mean, you know, for example, what I do, I have a unique sort of approach to that. And I mean, as opposed to I'm not the guy that's standing out in the truck stop in Fond du Lac, you know, waiting for the snow to come. I do think there is such a degree of as loyalty. I know. People, for example, Brian Goddard, who left Channel 4 a while back. I mean, people loved Brian Goddard. Sally Severson, who was at Channel 12 forever until she retired. I mean, I think there's no question that I think we do, if you have people that have been in a market for a while and they're able to build a degree of rapport with the listeners, I think, you know, there is that degree of familiarity. There's no question about it. The reporters that kind of come and go, the ones who are, again, moving up the ladder, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's how you do better and get more money. And I think you have to be in an area a while to establish yourself. David in Green Bay. David, you're on WTMJ.
Yes, sir.
Hi, David.
Hello.
Yeah. What do you think?
I'm in agreement that it's enjoyable to know who the people are. I wish that the people themselves would be good journalists and know how to pronounce the names of the city of our state if they're going to be good to be listening to.
Yeah.
I'd also like journalists to know the difference between singular and plural and tense.
Yeah.
For some odd reason, that's not involved at all.
Yeah, David, thanks for calling. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I'm kind of up against the clock. That is one of the things. It is the pronunciation of places, and it's always kind of brutal when you see the new reporter that comes on television, and they're talking about Oconomowoc or, you know, Muskego or whatever. You kind of go, huh? You know, there should, I think, definitely be these pronunciation sort of things whenever you get the new reporters there, because we are, and I don't say this in a bad way, I mean, this is unlike some cities and areas that are very transitory, where you have the population that turns over a lot, you know, here, you know, we're the people that tend to live around here tend to live around here for a long time. So it's always just intriguing to me about what ends up moving the needle. And I think people are kind of all over the map on this.